Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
My next guest has lived an extraordinary life as a test pilot, an astronaut, a spacewalker, a spaceship commander, a best-selling author, and now, I suppose, a space philosopher, Chris Hadfield. Welcome to the show.
It's a delight to be talking with you. Thanks.
So, Chris, you're going to take us through that extraordinary life in five songs. So will we start at the beginning? You grew up on a working farm. What was that like and how does that shape you?
It teaches you the great satisfaction that comes from physical labor. Planning ahead, working with the weather, just straight many hours of work. And there's a great fulfilled joy at the end of the day of having worked hard and being able to look at the field that you plowed or disked or harrowed or planted and see what you did. And it's an important lesson to learn, I think, that work isn't just what you do in order to enjoy life later, but you can actually find joy and meaning in work itself.
Okay. And your dad was a pilot mainly. What was he like?
My dad is a farmer mainly.
Okay.
He grew up as a farmer. So when he was 17, he was a full-time custom farmer out there planning and doing all the work. But his brother bought him an introductory ride in an airplane when he was about 18. And he thought, wow, that sounds like fun. And so he got his ratings and he became an airline pilot. But on an airline pilot, you only work maybe 12 days a month. And so the other, 18 days, he was living and working on the farm. So I grew up on a farm with a couple airplanes and a dad who would go off and go fly for the airline.
Okay, and you and your two brothers would all become pilots. So your father obviously sowed a seed in you there, yeah?
Well, he both sowed a seed and enabled it. He bought a little airplane that my brothers could learn flying in and build time in so that they could eventually work for an airline. For me, it was always a backup plan. I was thinking quite a bit higher in altitude.
It sounds like they were interesting people, your parents. They weren't doing the kind of 9-to-5 conventional life or whatever. He was farming away, but he had this kind of eccentric interest in having planes on the farm and everything. They were different, were they, to other people?
Yeah, it was definitely not a 9-to-5 existence. Farming is, sunrise to sunset and then longer if things go wrong. And my mom raised the five children. She also did a lot of other sort of ancillary work, but she originally trained as a nurse. But back in the days if you got pregnant, you could no longer go through nursing school. And when she was pregnant with my older brother, she had to stop her training as a nurse. And so she worked very hard raising us and supporting my dad. And I'm lucky they're both still alive. They're 91, and my mom's just about to turn 89, still living in that same farmhouse. And luckily, one of my sisters lives with them and makes sure that they're okay.
Okay. So let's go to your first music choice then, the Kingston Trio, Where Have All the Flowers Gone? What does this take you back to?
My dad, before he was hired as an airline pilot, did aerial mapping in an old World War II B-17, way up high, unpressurized airplane, but up over 30,000 feet, sucking oxygen through a tube, mapping Canada's north. And up there, not a lot of entertainment available, but they had these three-person folk band from the United States called the Kingston Trio. Three guys whose voices just, like sometimes a brother and sister, they're like the Carpenters, their voices just blend so well you can't even pick one from the other. The Kingston Trio was like that. But my dad sort of fell in love with the Kingston Trio while he was up in the high Arctic. And he had this big clunky old reel-to-reel tape player. And at home, my dad would always put on the tape while we were having dinner. The Kingston Trio would be singing in the background. And it taught me a love of music that tells a story, but also of a melody you can remember and harmonies.
Okay, let's go back to the Hadfield dinner table. So when Chris Hadfield was a child, here's the Kingston Trio, Where Have All the Flowers Gone?
Where have all the young men gone? Long time passing. Where have all the young men gone? Long time ago. Where have all the young men gone? Gone for soldiers, everyone. When will they ever learn? When will they ever learn?
soldiers gone a long, long time ago? Where have all the soldiers gone? Gone to graveyards, everyone.
And that's Chris Hadfield's first choice today, the Kingston Trio, Where Have All the Flowers Gone? And you were finding that very evocative, Chris.
Yeah, it's that sound. I'm sitting at the summer cottage right where I chose to be an astronaut in the evening, listening to those three voices.
So you grew up in the 60s when, I think if you compare it to now, certainly, people were quite optimistic about the future, and I suppose space particularly had kind of captured the public imagination hugely as well, hadn't it? So when did you get interested in space or realise this was something that might be for you?
I think to say that people were optimistic about the future in the 60s is wrong.
Yeah.
That's when the great race riots were going on in the United States and huge civil unrest and the Vietnam War killing people and fighting a war overseas that most Americans didn't understand. There was tremendous dissatisfaction and also a huge fear of the atomic threat of the Cold War, where people were taught in schools how to hide under their desks, and people built, you know, bomb shelter bunkers underneath their homes. It's easy to look back and think life was simple
or rosy at some point, but it was not. The Jetsons, that everyone was imagining that, you know, space, technology, science was all going to make life in the future all very different. So not like that at all.
It was part of what was going on. But I think there's always a perception that life used to be easier, and now that I'm an adult, life is way harder, and that's false. It always has been.
Okay.
But I 100% agree with you that it was the start of spaceflight. Spaceflight's younger than I am, and from the time that Yuri Gagarin flew on April the 12th, 1961, you know, it was 8 years, and they walked on the moon. And so there was a great rush of human capability and pride and opportunity and optimism that came with that.
Okay, so I think it was the moon landing was a big moment for you as a kid, was it, in terms of deciding your future?
Me and a third of the world, actually.
Yeah.
It was the most viewed event in human history at that point. But for me specifically, I watched that happen. And I thought, if those three people can do it, because there was Mike Collins orbiting the moon while Neil and Buzz stepped on the surface of the moon, they're not magic. They're not, I don't know, supermen or something. They're just people. Then why can't I do it? And I thought, of all the choices I have here in the summer that I turned 10, that's the coolest thing that's out there. And if that's a thing I can do, I want to do that.
Yeah, which is interesting, because a lot of people dream of a lot of things when they're 10. But they don't do a lot about it. But I've seen you say that I wasn't destined to be an astronaut. I had to turn myself into one. And that at 10 years old, you started deliberately changing yourself.
Well, I dream of winning a gold medal at the Olympics, but I don't do anything about it. So
yeah.
I'm never going to. You have to change who you are. And it was the same thing at 10 years old. I didn't dream of being an astronaut. I decided to turn myself into an astronaut. It's an entirely different mentality. And so then the question is, okay, if that's what's important to me in life, if that's what I really want to do, then what should I do this evening? What should I do this weekend? What show should I watch? What book should I read? Where should I go? What, you know, there's a million choices. But if you actually want to turn yourself into the person you dream of and maybe shape your life into the life that you dream of, you have to take action.
You're 9 or 10. What are the kind of steps you start taking at that point?
Well, I looked around at what skill set I had, which was virtually nothing. You know, I'm 9, turning 10.
Yeah.
But I realized...
I like that you did an audit of your
skill
set. Yeah,
did a little internal audit, looking down. Well, I don't have much to go on. But, you know, I can see with both eyes and I'm in reasonable shape. And okay, so they train for spacewalking underwater. Okay, so I already know how to swim, but I need to learn to swim well. And then I need to learn to snorkel. And then I need to learn to scuba dive. So, okay, great. I can do that pretty soon. And they all went to university and studied technical things. In fact, Buzz Aldrin has a PhD out of MIT. And I thought, okay, so I'm going to have to plan to go to university, whatever that is. My parents not only didn't go to university, they really didn't value it all that much. It was just something quite different to the choices they'd made in life. And they fly in space. I need to learn how to fly. So as soon as I was old enough, in Canada, we have a thing called Air Cadets. It's sort of like scouting, but with aviation. And Air Cadets taught me leadership. They taught me all the backgrounds. And by the time I was 15, I had my glider pilot's license. You know, before I was old enough to drive a car in Canada, they let me fly an airplane, and my powered license when I was 16. So it was just incremental gathering of skills and self-change to deliberately move myself in the direction of my dreams.
What an extraordinary young man you were. Were you very different then to the other kids around you in terms of what they were doing and stuff like that? Were you this very driven kind of kid, almost set apart a bit?
No, I've never considered myself driven. One of the greatest things that you can learn about yourself is that you have far more control than you think. And you can actually shape your own future. And if you choose to do nothing about it, then you are also shaping your own future. You have choices. I just thought, well, you know, I'm going to do something this weekend. I'm going to work on the farm, and I got to go to school and do my chores and all those other things. But what book should I read? You know, maybe I can convince my folks to take me to the science museum and stuff like that.
So I don't think I was choices.
Yeah, I don't think I was wildly different. At the time, I didn't notice. However, they did send me to a special school, you know, like they called it an enrichment program. Kids that had done well on IQ tests. But I think all of those things, my parental influences, the education system that Canada had available, but maybe most importantly, the visible inspiration that I saw from the first people that were traveling in space, those just gave me the pattern of life that I decided to follow.
Okay, your second music choice is Elton John, Candle in the Wind. Why this?
When I was on that farm growing up, the first long play big album that I bought is like a double album where it, you know, opens up and it's got that weird artistic kind of cover on it of Elton, you know, and lots of gold color and Yellow Brick Road album. And I listened to it and, you know, Funeral for a Friend is super powerful and Yellow Brick Road and the other songs in that album. But there's a song in there that's almost like a folk song. And it's the story of Marilyn Monroe. And I wore out that album listening to it. The other reason I mention it is because I got to meet Elton John and get to know him a little and just talk of life. And, you know, he's met a million people. I don't even remember. But for me, it was lovely to meet this guy that I'd been idolizing and thinking about since I was, you know, a young teen. When you talk to someone like that, and then at the same time you think, wow, this is the guy that put together that song that I've been listening to and loving for so long, you can't help but make you smile. And for me, the favorite song on the Yellow Brick Road album is that song about Marilyn Monroe, Candle in the Wind.
Okay, here's Chris Hadfield's second choice. That's Elton John, Candle in the Wind, and that's Chris Hadfield's second choice today. So you joined the cadets. How old were you when you joined the Canadian Air Force?
18. I finished high school early, and I still was young, and I was tired of school. So I worked for a while and then took 6 months off and bummed around Europe and traveled from the Arctic Circle down to the Mediterranean. And in that time, I decided, okay, this dream of being an astronaut, it's still super important to me. And what's the best path now? And I probably will never be an astronaut. So let's choose a path that has lots of great places to get off at jobs that I would be happy to do for the rest of my life. and I wanted to serve my country. I think everyone should serve the organization that has allowed them to thrive, that has supported them. Otherwise, you're more of a grifter than you are a supporter. And so I decided to join the Canadian Air Force to gain the skills that might qualify me someday to fly in space.
And you became ultimately a fighter pilot, did you?
We have training bases in Canada and out on the prairies where the weather is pretty predictable and the land is flat. I learned to fly airplanes more sophisticated than I had been flying, and then jets, and then fighters. I got selected to fly fighters. I was one of the first Canadian F-18 pilots, and I got sent to a NORAD squadron during the Cold War and intercepting Soviet bombers who were practicing attacks on North America.
So would the Soviets come into North American airspace?
Yes, there's a narrow airspace around a country within, you know, a dozen miles of the coast. But beyond that is an airspace called an Air Defense Identification Zone. And it goes out quite a range. And it's a different type of airspace. But the answer to your question is yes. The Soviets would come all the way into the air defense identification zone around Canada, and I would be sleeping next to the jet in the quick reaction facility. The horn would go off in the whatever time of night. We would race, throw on our G-suit, jump into the jet. We had to be airborne in 12 minutes, race out over the North Atlantic, and in fact, you had to be wearing a full dry suit, what we called a poopy suit, this big, cumbersome rubber suit, just in case you had to eject into the Atlantic so you wouldn't die, and then intercept the Soviet bombers before they could get to the line where they would be able to release their cruise missiles, which would wipe out all the communication and power nodes of North America. That's what I was doing in the 80s.
Okay, but this was not a confrontation as such. It was kind of a fake confrontation, was it? Or
I was in a fully armed F-18 with two heat-seeking missiles, two radar missiles, and a nose full of bullets. And I was intercepting an enemy aircraft in Canadian airspace of unknown purpose. So that's not pretend.
Wow.
However, I never had to fire a missile in anger. They were probing to see how we would respond, just understanding our ability to defend ourselves. And sometimes they were just on their way down to resupply missions in Cuba. Sometimes they were doing anti-submarine support. They were trailing a long wire. They had lots of models of that big Bear bomber. And sometimes they were doing a practice cruise missile launch profile. But when the horn went off in the middle of the night, we didn't know
100% real.
If it was real or not. Fortunately, it didn't flare up into loss of life.
Then later on in your career, things would turn a different kind of way when you ended up in Star City in Russia. Tell me about that and what you were doing there.
Yeah, the path from being a fighter pilot, I became a test pilot and then got selected by the Canadian Space Agency as an astronaut. And they sent me down to Houston, Texas. And so I became a Canadian astronaut in the NASA Astronaut Corps. And while you're getting ready and training for your own space flights, you do a lot of support jobs. But when we started building the International Space Station, we did it in concert with 14 other countries. And so working cooperatively with Russia, they have the longest of space traditions. They have mission control just on the north side of Moscow. And they have their cosmonaut training base in a little, very lovely semi-military base just to east of Moscow called Syuzhny Gorodok, which means starry town. But Western media called it Star City, which sounds way more Jetsons. Mm-hmm. And so that's where cosmonauts train, and that's where I trained. But we also keep a senior NASA representative there. And even though I was Canadian, NASA asked me to do it. And so I was NASA's director of operations in charge of the NASA office at Star City, Russia.
And how was the atmosphere there? Are things collegiate? Is it kind of tense? Are people trusting of each other? I guess you all have to trust each other if you're working together on something so precise and important.
Well, it's a very common purpose. We are training and, well, selecting and training and then launching the crews that are going to be on board the International Space Station. And they're from all different countries. They have to train. And so the atmosphere was independently trusting, completely self-contained, also very collegial. And once you are an astronaut training for a space flight, then everybody's job is very clear. You know, you go do sea survival in the Black Sea, you do winter survival out in the bush, all the various things.
So everybody had more in common than set them apart, basically, in this situation.
Oh, no, that's true of everything on Earth. We have far more in common than sets us apart. But we tend to focus on the things that separate us.
Yeah, that's interesting, because you studied the Russian language and Russian culture and everything. I think you have a good insight into Russian people and the psyche of them, which at the moment, I think they feel very alien to a lot of us, Russia. And indeed, we're not kind of 100% sure about how the people feel about things either. What would be your insights into Russia and Russians?
Yeah, all told, I lived in Russia for about 5 years and studied the language for 20 years, so I speak it passably. And I was the pilot of a Russian spaceship, and I helped build the Russian space station. So lots of Russian experience. Russia's an ancient culture, you know, 1,000 years there on the banks of the Moskva. But a country with no natural borders, and they have been invaded countless times, you know, the Mongol hordes, Genghis Khan, and people coming up through the Caucasus, and people coming across from Europe, Napoleon, Hitler. And so it's not like Ireland. It's not even like the UK. It's not like Canada or the United States, which are sort of defined on their extremities by water to the most degree. Russia feels a great vulnerability, and they had centuries of wickedness happen to them. And a lot of their decisions and their fears, which are realistic, are the result of Russian history. And you can see it being personified by the terrible decisions that Putin is making for the world right now. But it's that primal, fundamental Russian fear of invasion and the absolute necessity to have buffer states around it to protect the motherland. I mean, Ukraine means out on the edge. You know, it's that sort of perspective. Okay. But when you roll it back to the average Russian citizen, they're just doing the best they can. They're just living their lives like anywhere. And they see that war in Ukraine as a thing that's on the edge of their existence.
Okay, you're going Canadian for your third music choice, which is Neil Young and Heart of Gold. You chatted to him from space, didn't you?
While I was on board the space station, our psychological support people said, "Who do you want to talk to keep you in good spirits?" And so I chose Canadian musicians, and my dream was to talk to Neil Young. And he told me, when you're creating something, don't judge it until it's done. Like, allow yourself the freedom to complete the work of art. As a young guitar player, this song was one I played many times and copied, and I wish I'd written.
Okay, here's Chris Hadfield's third choice, Neil Young, Heart of Gold.
I've been to Hollywood, I've been to Redwood, I crossed the ocean for a heart of gold. I've been in my mind, it's such a fine line that keeps me searching for a heart.
Neil Young and Heart of Gold. That was Chris Hadfield's third choice today. You married your wife, Helena, when you were quite young. Do wives and families of would-be astronauts have to be very much on board with the dream and accept what they're getting themselves in for?
Yeah, my wife's name is Helena, and we met in a high school play. And she was just turning 15, and I'd just turned 16, so quite young. We married 6 years later, had 3 children and now 2 grandchildren. I'm sure I told her early on that, hey, by the way, I really want to be an astronaut someday. And I'm sure she just saw that as, okay, fine, but nothing realistic. But it's good that he has dreams anyway. Mm-hmm. But we got married in my 4th year of military college. And the military immediately posted us to Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, which is about as urban as it sounds, and then up to Cold Lake, Alberta, and then to Northern Quebec. And my wife had already finished university, was a computer programmer, but there was no way she was going to be able to get work in those places. So we thought, well, let's have kids right away. And amazingly enough, that worked. But when we were in northern Quebec, I was intercepting the Soviets from that base, and our daughter was born there. We had to decide what we were going to do next. And then Challenger exploded, killed everybody on board, including a school teacher named Krista McAuliffe. And I just thought, well, that's the end of that. You know, there's no way the American people are going to trust NASA to do that again. They killed a school teacher. And so I thought, well, it was a great dream, but I need a more practical plan. So I started getting my pilot ratings to become an airline pilot. And my wife, when she caught wind of what I was doing, she said, what are you doing? And I told her, and she said, giving up on your dreams doesn't come for free. It's going to have a cost. And if you give up on your dreams because you think we demand that you do it, whether you think about it or not, you're going to resent that for the rest of your life. And you don't need to give up yet. You don't know what's going to happen with NASA. And you want to be a test pilot anyway. And we're not making much money, but we have enough.
But presumably in all that as well is an acceptance by her that you could die.
Well, everyone dies.
Yeah, that you could die doing this.
Not a matter of could. Everyone dies.
Yeah.
You got to get over that right away.
Yeah.
But if you're going to do a risky profession, then again, if you ask my wife, she'd say, if I denied him the things that are important to him, that would steal joy from his life. He'd be a lesser man. And why would I do that? So, yeah, she has a pretty practical attitude towards things.
Yes, an extraordinary woman. Your next music choice is Brandi Carlile, The Story. Does this hark back to what you were saying earlier about liking music that has a story to it?
This song, it's kind of an anomaly for me. I was watching Austin City Limits, which is a great place where people perform live on video or television. And I was just amazed by not just the sound of this song, but the visual spectacle of these two guys who look identical, who are playing bass and guitar and kind of energetic looking guys. And then she looks like a folk singer standing out front, but what she does with her voice just like rips your head off. It's unbelievable. And this song starts so beautifully and gently and then just roars into it. And it does, it's an extremely vulnerable set of lyrics as well. If this song ever comes in, I need to stop everything I'm doing and just listen to it from end to end.
This is quality music analysis here. We don't get this from people usually, okay? Here's Chris Hadfield's fourth choice, Brandi Carlile and The Story.
All of these lands across my face tell you the story of who I am. So many stories of where I've been, and now I got to where but these stories don't mean anything when you've got no one to tell them to. It's true, I was made for you. I climbed across the mountain tops, swam all across the ocean.
Brandi Carlile, The Story, and that was Chris Hadfield's fourth music choice today. Just before we go to your final music choice, some kind of quickie questions for you. Does going to space make you more or less inclined to think there's a God?
Whatever you believe beforehand is going to be deepened by the experience of leaving Earth. I don't know of anybody in the shuttle era or afterwards who's had a religious epiphany, but some of the guys who walked on the moon did, because they were so unprepared for what it was going to mean to them.
Okay. Does it change you? Because, you know, we literally have a phrase in the English language to come back down to earth, right? When you come back down to earth after doing something like that, that's so intense and a kind of a pinnacle of an existence, really, is anything else ever really the same or as important again?
Did you listen to William Shatner? You know, he was an actor and on Star Trek, but he flew on one of those little short tourist flights. He had an epiphany. It changed him. He's a grizzled 90-year-old tough actor guy, and he was shocked by his lack of previous understanding of what spaceflight was going to be like and the difference between our world and the rest of the universe. But as a professional astronaut, I'd been thinking about it since I was 9, and I'd been training about it for 26 years before my first spaceflight. So I was far more ready for it. And I think that process of training shaped me equally to the magnificence of the spaceflight itself. It reaffirmed a lot of the things that I'd prepared myself for. But I do see the world differently. I've been around the planet 2,650 times. I've seen all 8.2 billion people over and over and over again conducting their lives. I've seen the wicked, war-torn hotspots and then the tremendous preponderance of peaceful life on the planet. I've seen the age of the world. I've gone from one side of the sun to the other, watched the entire seasons of the world swap ends on the planet like it was taking a breath. And that's how I see the world every day. When I walk around the streets of Dublin, I'm seeing more than just, you know, the stone and the wet.
You're seeing the big picture, not what we all try and do. You worked with Elon Musk, SpaceX at one point. What do you think of him now?
SpaceX is leading the entire world in launch. They have developed, they've taken advantage of 60 years of NASA's work and other people's work to create an amazing launch capability that has dropped the cost of access to space and opened up space business like we've been dreaming of. It's
when
phenomenal,
the impact
of
that. When he uses his powers for good.
Well, you know, the thousands and thousands of people that work for SpaceX, you can pretend it's just one person. It is not, of course. And it's Gwynne Shotwell, a woman who runs SpaceX. But the incredibly bizarre and mercurial and at times horrific person, you know, has his name associated with it. Some of the things he's done recently are inexcusable.
He's insulted my
country and said things that I just find completely inexplicable and unforgivable. And
deal with him personally at the time?
No, I met him, but no. But people, you know, pretend that SpaceX is one person. It's like pretending the United States is one person or Russia is one person. It's easier for you to then make crass judgments, but it's wrong.
Okay, your final choice is Christy Moore, right on. You have a big connection to this song, don't you?
I've been a musician my whole life. I've performed in bands. I'm always the front man in bands. I love a song that is so unbelievably simple, and yet the painting of the words in Ride On is so deft and descriptive. It's such a minimalist and magnificent song, and I couldn't count the number of times I've played this song. And I absolutely love it. I play it differently than Christy does, but everybody interprets music differently. It's, again, it's one of those many, many songs that I'd wish I'd been talented and clear enough thinking to have written myself. It's a lovely song.
You've done a few good things yourself in life as well. You made your choices, Chris. Listen, congratulations, by the way. You have a new granddaughter, I believe.
I do. Her name is Wren. My daughter is a professor at Trinity here in Dublin. And Wren is now just almost 3 weeks. And I know of nothing better than to be a grandfather of a new baby granddaughter.
Really?
I'm the luckiest and richest person
in the
world.
I think a lot of you grandparent people find it better than you found having kids the first time around.
Oh, far better. Yeah, it's all of the delight with very little of the day-to-day slogging responsibility. And I'm grateful for that. We have three children of our own. That wasn't easy, and it never will be. Having a granddaughter is like the reward.
Okay. So your children have to watch you besotted now with their children.
I am, yes.
Everyone knows that story. You've a new book coming out in the autumn, Chris.
Yeah, it's called Final Orbit. It's the third in my thriller fiction series, and I'm really happy with it.
Okay, fantastic. And you will also be appearing in the Borgosh Theatre on June 15th with your show, A Journey into the Cosmos. And for tickets and more information on that, people can go to bgetheatre.ie. Chris Hadfield, it's been a pleasure. And we'll finish on your final music choice. This is Christy Moore and Ride On. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you so much.
When you ride into the night without a thread. drifts behind. Run your claw along my gut one last time. I turn to face an empty space where you used to lie, and look for the spark that lights the night through a teardrop in my eye. Ride on, see you. I could never go with you no matter how I wanted to. Ride on.